And now.
Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. Everybody loves me. Anyhow, that's how I feel. Wow, I feel just like a Pollyanna. I should worry, not for nothing. Everybody loves me. Yes, they do. And I love everybody since I fell in love. Personality. I can't help thinking it's no one else but me. Gee, I feel just about 10 feet tall. Having a ball, guess you might call me Pollyanna. Everybody loves a lover.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hey, everybody, this is Phil Lairness, and if you can tell we're laughing, it's because really in some weird way we're laughing at you.
No, I'm Dean Haglund. We're laughing at a situation where we would instead record this, we would just call our fans individually and just talk to them for an hour.
Yeah, just yeah. It might technologically some days it might be easier just to call you guys on the phone and do the show that way. You know, we could probably make it a conference call in a few different listeners at one time.
Because you think in our 13th year of doing this, we would have some sort of thing ready that you would just click. And then we could just start recording.
Well, yeah, and that's possible once I can start seeing things again. I
mean, oh,
yeah. That is. That's the problem is that, you know.
Has your eyesight got worse?
Oh, a lot worse. A lot worse. Oh. So, but anyway, so let's hip pocket that idea that we were having where we would, I guess, have a flow chart of when do our listeners like to listen to the show? And we could make it easier on them. Like we could call them, you ride the train at this hour and that's when you like to listen to it. Now, do you have Wi-Fi or reception so that we can Skype or call while you're on the train and do it live? Okay, great.
We'll call
8:45 a.m. on Monday morning. There you go. What you doing?
Right, because even though it's an hour show, the extra hour it takes us just to get the thing up and recording would be sort of
I would think within a good 4 or 5 days we're able to call everybody individually and do the show. And you know, you all can just keep doing what you're doing. You don't need to participate. Just, you know, okay. Yeah. That's great. You're at work? Okay, keep writing that memo and we're gonna discuss Shazam.
Right.
All right.
I guess it would use up some minutes, though. I guess that's the one downside we didn't think of.
But this is, I think, actually going to be a very interesting show. I think we started year 13 last week, and it was a very funny show. And
yeah.
And I think this one's going to be really interesting. I was realizing in the notes of what we need to cover, or what I'd like to cover, so much history to talk about. And from a lot of different angles, and I think we might even have you and I some controversial takes about the history that we will be discussing. But I would be remiss, yes, if I did not offer up at least a mea culpa that we're no longer doing what we'd been doing while you were in Australia, which was getting the show pretty regularly to people 9 a.m. Monday morning Pacific time. By the time we finish recording and by the time I get everything done and rest my eyes, it's been well into the evening here Mondays before I've been able to get the show up. And the effort to rebuild the website and build it out entirely is taking longer than it would once I get my eyes fixed. So bear with us just for a little bit longer, if you would. I did have a meeting with the surgeon that went very, very well this this week. So
What did he say?
Well, surgery. Surgery is scheduled. Gotta like that her name's Lily. That's a good omen. But so the first surgery is scheduled. The first of what might very well be three is scheduled on July 3rd. But because of the rarity of my cataracts and the difficulties that they present, I've got really nonstop battery of tests between now and then because measurements are almost impossible.
Wow. Wow. So you have a rare cataract.
Oh yeah. It's both where it is and the type that it is. And then you throw in some different things, which is my age and really just my attitude. And it all becomes really quite a standout test. But so the thing is that some of the things they have to do to my eyes in order to conduct these tests do further worsen my eyesight every time I go in for tests.
Oh no.
Yeah. So it's going to be really touch and go over the next several weeks with that, but at least we have a date in mind and I'll keep everybody informed in that. But I would like to offer this, and I think I mentioned this last week after my first meeting with the surgeon got canceled. You know, so many of us, either ourselves or we have loved ones who deal with medical, you know, health situations that require either us or as agents acting on behalf of loved ones. It forces us to deal with bureaucracy and no shortage of bureaucratic behavior, right? Especially when dealing with insurance companies and medical companies and all this. And something that Greg DeBellis, our composer on The Truth Is Out There and The Lady Killers mentioned, and I mentioned this last week, but I just want to really stress how true this is. You need to the best of your ability, funnel all the frustration and the anger or the powerlessness you might feel into, don't ignore it, don't block it, but use it as fuel to be able to convey in emotional terms what you or your loved one is going through so that the people you deal with have a reason to care. I don't want to make it sound like any of these people are uncaring or unfeeling. That's the point. But it is what they do for a living day after day after day, hour after hour. And when you are able to connect with them on a human level, on an emotional level, it really does make a world of difference, not only in terms of, I think, the treatment that you can get, but in terms of how they feel about their job. Because the truth is they see so much rough stuff and have to go through so much bureaucracy themselves and so much red tape themselves and so much paperwork and so much routine. Plus, they see sometimes such traumatic stuff themselves that it's only human nature to try to protect ourselves as much as we can. And so it really is important to connect and give them an emotional reason to care. I don't know if that makes sense how I'm saying it, but I've really witnessed that it makes all the difference. And really, going back to trying to get Fuzz Aldrin the care that she needed when she was dying, I actually witnessed this then. I was depending on who you spoke to at these hospitals. The greatest pet owner they'd ever dealt with. They loved me or they feared me.
Right.
And honestly, those are two really good options, to be loved or feared. Really, it's very powerful when dealing with a bureaucracy in anything. If you are loved, you get different treatment. If you are feared, you get different treatment. So anyway, that's my advice. That's my advice to all of you. And I will share it individually when we begin to call you all to do this show.
Well, I already fear that advice. So,
all right.
Right there.
So we promised last week, and apropos of our special opening this week that you heard and enjoyed, we need to talk about the iconic Doris Day as we open up the Chill Pack Morgue for something we like to call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
And of course, we begin, Dean.
Yes.
With dead at 7 years of age, Grumpy Cat.
No. Oh, I know, with a urinary tract infection of all things. Now, seriously, that has symptoms that, well, I guess you have to watch your cat closely pee to see it. But I'm shocked that in this day and age, with regular vet visits, and a cat as worth as much as it was, that it died of a UTI. That seems extraordinary to me.
Yeah, but a cat worth as much because it was what?
Dwarfing and...
It was grumpy. The cat was worth a lot of money because it was grumpy. And no. Maybe it was grumpy because... So, see, the thing that killed it might have been the reason for its popularity in the first place.
Okay, so A, it wasn't a grumpy cat. That was just its natural expression. Our cat, Loki, when has a funny coloration in its mouth, so that when you look at it dead on, oh it God. Looks sad. Yeah, but when you look at it from the side, it looks smiling. So that's a fun thing.
You're spending way too much time up close to Loki's mouth, first of all. I know that, and I take a break from kissing my cat on the mouth to tell you that. Okay. Grumpy Cat dead at 7. I've got nothing more to add, but I'm glad that you did some research on this.
Well, you know, what's the first thing in my Doberman and cat feeds? I mean, that's all that comes in my books.
I know. So. All right. I may be signing you up for a couple of secret Facebook groups that you might want to check. All right. So Doris Day. We didn't really get a chance to talk about her except broad strokes last week. You were kind of surprised that she was still alive because it, quite frankly, it had been so long, 50 years since she'd been acting. But then again, for like I had said, you know, people in the animal rights movement, she was still very active and iconic. She died at 97 at her home in Carmel. She got her start in show business as a big band singer back in, I think, 39.
Wow.
Working with such band leaders as Bob Crosby and Les Brown and his Band of Renown.
Of course.
And it was with Les Brown that she notched her first hit, 1945's Sentimental Journey. And what a great tune that is. I mean... Mm-hmm. She continued to score hits, including My Dreams Are Getting Better All the Time, Till the End of Time, which Perry Como did a very famous version of, and I Got the Sun in the Morning, and I Got the Sun in the Morning. Okay, I'm having a lot of trouble reading, in case you can't tell. I think you can hear the frown on my face as I try to read these things.
Who's a grumpy cat now?
Exactly. Who's the grumpy cat now, motherfuckers? All right. So, but Everybody Loves a Lover, which I used as the opening, is one of, I think, my five favorite songs of all time. And yes, I probably have 50 songs on my list of five favorite songs of all time. But still, just to be nominated, you're a winner. She continued to, you know, sing and score so many hits. She reached new audiences with her U.S. tours, of course, and regular appearances on Bob Hope's radio program.
Oh.
And this was really interesting because, you know, when I did a variety show last year, Goodbye 40s, Hello 50s, as a fundraiser for the Breakfast Club on my 50th birthday, turned 50 on stage, and we set it in New Year's Eve, 1949. And in preparation for it, I listened to all the Bob Hope radio shows from late 1949 and early 1950, because how better to get a sense of the news events that were making monologues than to listen to Bob Hope monologues, right?
Yeah.
And Doris Day was a frequent guest on this show, And it kind of surprised me at first because it's like, well, they're just using her as a singer, and they seem to be propping her up in these comedy sketches when she clearly has a flair for it. Why this kind of weird misogyny for such a big star? And I didn't realize, of course, that she hadn't become an actress yet.
Oh.
Yeah.
You're kidding. So she wasn't acting all the time. She was a singer and then took to acting.
Yeah, it was songwriter Sammy Kahn who urged her to take a chance at a film career. And she won her first movie role replacing Betty Hutton, who had become pregnant, in Romance on the High Seas. And this led, I think this is early 50s, like right around 1950. And it led to a 20-year career as a motion picture actress. She, of course, starred in films of many genres, including musicals, comedies, dramas, and thrillers. Played the title role in Calamity Jane in 1953, right?
Right.
Stars alongside James Stewart in Hitchcock's remake of his own The Man Who Knew Too Much. But her best-known films are those in which she co-starred with Rock Hudson, chief among them, 1959's Pillow Talk, for which she was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actress.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
She also
made, you look at it, she's really good, but it's also a light comedy.
Exactly. Something. Can you imagine people getting nominated for light comedies for performance? I mean...
No. That's the thing. Where, well... And you think you should, and the Emmys certainly are, but yeah, rarely in a, I cannot think how many comedies get nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
Very few.
Maybe writing, right? Maybe a screenplay.
Yeah.
Because we do appreciate how hard it is to write good gags, but for some reason, there still is this idea that performing them is somehow easier, not sufficiently weighty a challenge.
Right.
And we know different. anyway, she also made quite a great screen pairing with James Garner. There's an actor, I also think, because of his gift and facility for comedy, never was probably really... I think he, as big a star as he was for as long as he was, I think James Garner was probably underrated as an actor.
Yeah, you know... I really like his throwaway demeanor, that casual thing.
Yeah.
When you make it seem so throwaway, you're never taken seriously about how hard it is to get that kind of looseness.
And, you know, there's something about comedy, not all comedies, but a lot of comedies, right? You play drama, you play the stakes in drama, you know, for real, but you play the stakes in comedy for even more real, like for even higher stakes.
Right.
And he was really good at that. He was really, really. So anyway, they starred in both Move Over, Darling and The Thrill of It All, which was a big hit. She also co-starred. I mean, look at this list of people she co-starred with. Clark Gable, Cary Grant, James Cagney, David Niven, Jack Lemmon, Frank Sinatra, Richard Widmark, Kirk Douglas, Lauren Bacall, Rod Taylor, in a variety of movies. And not all of them were good, but I mean, if you're being paired against those people, you know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah, you're a big name. you're doing great.
But not just a big name, you're getting the job done, right?
Yeah, you're delivering.
She ended her film career in 68, only briefly, removed from the height of her popularity. So she didn't, it had crested, but, she was quick to move into other things like she was, with acting. Right. But then she in 68 moved into her own sitcom, moved to the small screen. And had the Doris Day Show from 68 to 73.
I sort of not remember that. I think I saw it like reruns of it.
As of this decade, she was one of eight performers. I don't know if there's anybody this decade that has changed this, but the last time I checked, there were eight performers who had been the top box office earner in the U.S. four times. There were eight actors, eight performers who achieved that, and she was one of them.
Wow.
In 2011, Dean, she released her 29th studio album.
She's 29.
Yes. And so she's 89 years old, releases her 29th album, My Heart, which contained new material, and in Europe became a top 10 album. She received a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. And, you know, again, we don't want to give short shrift. She was an activist for animal welfare. The Doris Day Animal Foundation funds so many nonprofits working to help animals. And the Doris Day Animal League is a lobbying organization on behalf of animal rights and humane treatment of animals in the U.S. She was married. Now, this is the part that kind of I want to talk about a little bit.
Okay.
She was married four times, including one husband who ruined her finances, left her penniless. Fortunately, she had one son, musician and record producer Terry Melcher, quite a famous producer. Who himself died in 2004, but he repaired Doris Day's finances.
Oh.
And, you know, a lot through catalog, repackaging, and, you know, reissuing and relicensing her recordings and things, and
right.
really tended to her state, and a good son. So, But Doris Day is an icon of a certain type of Americana, and right. a type of Americana that, let's say, we gravitate towards when we think we want to make America great again. A 50s and 60s Americana that was, it was simpler, it was sweeter, it was non-sexual, it was not sexually threatening in any way, virginal, one could even say. And, you know, she herself was quite a conservative political icon. She was a lifelong conservative. And this is exactly what pisses me off about conservatives, right?
Okay.
Is so often it doesn't matter who you are so much as what you claim you stand for.
Right.
Right? I
okay.
mean, how many years did I spend hearing people, including my own parents, talk about the dangers of liberal permissiveness, where this would lead us? Well,
right.
where would it lead us? I don't know, what, four failed marriages and, you know, having a husband that robs you blind? I mean, you know, the dangers of hypocrisy. And one of the things that I think, you know, we still face, and that I'm really wrestling with is how conservative movements like to cloak themselves as champions of liberty while constantly coming down against people's freedoms of choice and behavior and lifestyles.
Yeah. Well, that's true, isn't it? It's a liberty, a freedom. Well, because they see the choices and the lifestyles as a abomination.
Well, as a personal affront and threat to them and their way of life. Nothing,
right.
nothing frightens us and pisses us off more than seeing someone live freely. Especially in this country.
Mm.
It takes, that's why it takes such great courage, I think, for anyone to live freely.
Right.
And to be who they are, to explore who they are, to express who they are, to share their perception of what life means, takes an inordinate amount of courage. And so much of the Americana that she represents that we still pine for is built on hiding who you are, lying about who you are.
Isn't that interesting, huh? So that 50s ideal, that conservative, that Eisenhower era, as I was trying to remember, that's about hiding the true nature. which then theoretically was the 60s, was the expression of that rebellion against all that hiding.
I was thinking about the 80s a lot this weekend when I was teaching an acting intensive, and we were working on one script in particular, Margin Call, a brilliant script all about the financial collapse in 2008. But right. It was interesting because, you know, we were thinking to the 1980s, we were thinking about how much of Wall Street and high finance as late as last decade and maybe even now feels like Mad Men. I mean, the technology changes, but it's still this patriarchal boys club from a bygone era in terms of the behavior. And I was thinking about the 1980s for some reason. I think the 1980s comes up, a year comes up in the film. And I was thinking, you know, I was coming of age then. And I remember how it's really this interesting time where in the 80s, there was such a gravitation towards 50s nostalgia. In part embodied by, or maybe paving the way for, Reagan, who himself was a 50s icon, right?
Exactly.
But at the same time, that's the exact time when investment banking and Wall Street becomes what it is today.
They entrench their modus operandi.
Yeah, it becomes different than it was. I mean, under the cover of this kind of innocent conservatism that we gravitate towards. It's really, really interesting. And, you know, getting back to Mr. Lynch, who we talked about last week, you know, this is always one of the most interesting things about him is when, because you feel that he has both an affection for this banal innocence and recognizes and has an affection for the utter corruption that's always going on beneath it.
Right. Yeah, interesting. The utter corruption. Yeah, well, is it, I'm trying to think, is that hypocrisy or is that learned behavior?
Well,
right.
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, the reason that it's utter corruption, there is something that is getting corrupted always when you disown something. And right. So if we are pretending that things are a way they are not, look, all of us walk through the world in some degree faking it until we make it, right?
Right.
And that's helpful. Otherwise, we get taken by sometimes our worst impulses, and now we're just allowed to give free rein to our worst impulses. But if we still lived in a society where we say, you know what, it's not all right to constantly lash out, then we've got to sometimes swallow it and smile and walk and pretend we're in a good mood. And damn if before long we actually aren't in a good mood. And thank God we didn't give in to that bad impulse.
Right.
So there is a certain amount of faking it till we make it. But when you're talking about not exploring who you are out of fear that it won't be accepted, out of pressure that you're supposed to be something else, whatever it is, then you're talking about not an impulse, you're talking about an energetic drive that is becoming disowned. And if you don't feed a snake becomes hungry, right? So
exactly.
That's the thing, is that it culturally so much was disowned. And so never mind the politics of when you hear Make America Great Again, that for some people it means, wait a minute, great, like when we didn't have rights? And then you're into this fight about, well, no, that's of course not what we mean. And not, you know, and then there's good people on both sides, apparently. But it in and of itself is a craving for such a dangerous time. It's a dangerous time when we kept so much secret.
Right. Yeah. You could not come out of the closet. You could not it would actually be literally a death sentence for you to express yourselves for who you were.
Yeah, and that didn't even just mean, you know, sexuality I mean, again, how great is it that there's an entire swath of our population that's, you know, again, swooning over Doris Day and what she represented, you know, in movies most famously in which she co-stars with Rock Hudson. The irony is so delicious if only anyone would be willing to take a bite. All right, we need to move on because there are other giants that we need to discuss that made no shortage of historical impact themselves. And one of them is the writer Herman Wouk. Who wrote the classic novel The Caine Mutiny.
Oh, yeah.
He died at the age of 103, 10 days shy of his 104th birthday. He was working on a new novel. He published his memoirs, his autobiography, at age 100, which I think is the way to do it.
Yeah, you wait 100 years.
Yeah, wait till you have something to tell, and most of the people you're telling about are dead. That's when you do it. Yeah. But he also did the World War II epics, The Winds of War and War and Remembrance, which led to so many, popular adaptations in Caine Mutiny, for God's sakes. It was a play. It was a movie. Winds of War, the most watched television miniseries that, brought Robert Mitchum back to public consciousness. So he launched Product Locomotives, for God's sakes. And he won a Pulitzer for The Caine Mutiny, a novel about Navy Captain Queeg. Authority figure who goes mad with power and while causing his crew to revolt. So I have a lot of notes about him, and it's too much of a struggle for me to read them. but my sister was a big, big fan of the sprawling epic novel. I think of the James Michener's of the world, right? The James Clavell's, the Herman Wouk. Wouk? I don't know. It's W-O-U-K. But I wish I could blame mispronunciation on my eyesight, but since I know how it's spelled, I don't know. I could still
I could go,
Google, tell me how to spell Herman or pronounce Herman Wouk. But I'm also not only blind, but I'm fundamentally lazy. Okay. I get a sense that these kind of books, interestingly enough, never your cup of tea.
Grand epics, I do recall a leisurely summer that led into the winter of reading Of Human Bondage by S. Summer Maugham.
Wait a minute. So, a leisurely summer that led into a winter of human bondage? Is that what you just said?
No.
I want to hear. Well, now you have a memoir.
No, the novel is called Of Human Bondage.
Oh, I see. So, okay.
Yeah.
Because it was a summer of leisure that led into a winter of human bondage that led to a summer of our discontent.
No, and then what about that Anthony Burgess novel that went on forever? It wasn't Clockwork Orange for sure. It was a lesser one, but it.
I would get into epic novels, but not really these epic novels of war.
Right.
I feel like Hemingway is as close as I would get to epics about war. They're such intimate novels. I really did enjoy, the play Caine Mutiny a lot during my formative years, especially. It was quite a good read. So that's a major figure. 103 years old. I mean, we've been talking so much of late about how many World War II heroes we've been losing.
Right.
And to think, that's right. Also, the chroniclers of these heroes will, if they have not already, will be leaving us in short order.
Isn't that true?
One that I'm I've been looking forward to talking to you about. I mean, if there was a cuter man in the field of architecture than I.M. Pei, I do not know who that man was. He was a snickerdoodle, if ever there was one. I.M. Pei, our architect behind such notable buildings as the John F. Kennedy Library, the Louvre Museum's glass and steel pyramid, he died last week at the age of 102.
That's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
I know. That was pretty impressive.
His full name, oh goodness, here we go, Yao Ming Pei, was born April 1917 in Suzhou, China, raised in Hong Kong and Shanghai. And here's a little trivia. I mean, you're going to know more about his architecture and his buildings than I do, but let me see if I can stump you, stump the band.
Very good.
What was it that, why did he come to America?
Cultural revolution. He went.
Metaphorically, a cultural revolution is right, but not the cultural revolution you think of. It's the cultural revolution called motion pictures, because he fell in love with American movies. And so he wanted to come to school here, particularly those movies that starred Bing Crosby. Just when you think I.M. Pei can't get cuter.
He's a big Crosby fan.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? It's so great. Like, I mean, already he's kind of the anti, in terms of personality and demeanor, he's the anti Frank Lloyd Wright. Okay. who never met a good mood that he did not want to piss on. Here, I.M. Pei comes to all of this with a Bing Crosby song in his heart.
How sweet.
So he attended college in the U.S., applied to a number of colleges, decided on the University of Pennsylvania, though he later transferred to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He studied architecture. He found inspiration in the modern designs of Le Corbusier, and Frank Lloyd Wright.
Can't get wrong.
And you know, we had a presentation on Frank Lloyd Wright last week at the Breakfast Club.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And so it was fun because I got to introduce our musical director, Don Snyder, by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, now asking the musical question: how can it be wrong when it feels so Frank Lloyd Wright?"
Jesus.
Anyway,
laughs aplenty.
There were laughs aplenty. Come on. Laughs aplenty, by the way, is the name of my new podcast. It's got double F's, of course, in the laughs. That's what lets you know it's funny. So he graduated college in 1940. The war kept him in the U.S. Until after the completion of his studies. He joined the war effort in the National Defense Research Committee, and later became a professor at Harvard University. He began designing with the firm of Webb and Knapp in 1948, working on projects including the Mile High Center in Denver, Colorado,
right,
and Lafont Plaza in Washington, D.C. Struck off on his own in the 1950s and 60s, establishing really his unique vision with projects including the Mesa Laboratory of the National Center for Atmospheric Research near Boulder, Colorado, and the Luce Memorial Chapel at Taiwan's Tsinghua University. He, in 1964, Jackie Kennedy personally selected him as the architect for the John F. Kennedy Library, a project that stretched out over many years of disagreements. And though he ended up being not entirely satisfied with the final result, he nevertheless considered it his most important commission. And certainly it raised his profile. But again, what a difference between someone like him and Frank Lloyd Wright, who never met a project he could not get into disagreements about, and then he would abandon them and say to somebody else, "Finish them, and I might respond to your telegrams, I may not." So talk to me about I.M. Pei. Are you a fan? Is there any work in particular that...
I like the East Wing at the National Gallery in Washington, when that gallery had to expand. The many submissions from many other of the architects was to try just do a pared down neocolonial extension of the building as is, whereas he went completely the opposite direction. and made a space that seemingly incongruous, right? I mean, it's on the east building, it's quite a big cementy structure with some precursors to the pyramid at the Louvre, right? He has some sort of a triangular glass pieces, if I recall, on the front side, on the far side.
That actually struck me when I was looking at some aerial photos of it. Yeah, realizing, wow, I don't think from the inside I ever quite appreciated that before.
Yeah, yeah. So he has a thoughtful a thing about the surroundings and the context the building goes into, even if it's, super incongruous at first look. I mean, right, everybody in France, he apparently was getting death threats over putting the pyramid as the lobby for the Louvre in that. But now you see it and you go, how brilliant is that piece of architecture?
Yeah, they love it. And in fairness, they hated it and they gave him death threats until they saw it completed, which is always... let it not be said that the French are not willing to fly off the handle and jump to conclusions. Because indeed it was said that no work of architecture in France had been so hated since the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
Buildings like whores, if they live long enough, they become respectable.
And if you're in Los Angeles driving down Wilshire's, hang a left, I guess, if you're at the at Santa Monica where the old CAA agency offices are, and there that curved building is an IMPAI design.
Yeah, so that's where the Century Plaza the Odeon Cinemas and the I forget what the name of that.
No, not that far up. It's more in the Beverly Hills.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Wilshire across from the Hilton.
All right.
Merv Griffin's old Hilton.
Yeah.
Directly across from that on Santa Monica.
Whoa.
At Santa Monica Wilshire is an IMP kind of clever thing, and it's curved on one side, so it's sort of not overbearing. While at the same time taking in the thoughtful use of sunsets and skylines.
So here's some cute stuff about him, too. Like going back to the Louvre Pyramid, of course, which is such a critical piece in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, right?
Right.
Both the book and the movie, right? And one of the reasons that it's, tied in is the 666 panes of glass that are used, right? Is a key part of the conspiracy decoding and all this. And Pei was so delighted by it that he never bothered to correct them and point out that there's 673 panes of glass. Never let the facts get in the way of a cute story. Just a couple other buildings here. I mean, this is amazing, yeah. Just the array of stuff. When you think about it around the world, he did the Rock and Roll Museum Hall of Fame
in
Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
The Islamic Center of Art in Qatar.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And the Suzhou Museum, which is right by his birthplace, which is cool. Yeah, it was the Museum of Islamic Art in Qatar.
That's cool.
So obviously he was given all widely recognized and given all the highest awards architects can receive.
Yes.
But really, I mean, again, it's fair to say iconic. I mean, another absolute icon, because you may not know much about architecture, but he is one of those names you know.
Exactly. And you've seen one of his buildings in some skyline somewhere.
Yeah.
Even though you don't know it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you've noticed it, probably. Realistically,
yeah, for sure.
You've noticed it because it's such a unique vision. All right. And that brings us to... an icon of the comedy world, less, Tim Conway.
Oh, yeah. How sad is that, eh?
86 years of age, I think he was, maybe 85, not quite 86. American comedian, writer, director. You know, I guess he first comes really to fame when he plays Ensign Parker in McHale's Navy.
McHale's Navy, yeah.
And then, pretty funny. And then, of course, huge success in the Carol Burnett Show, and did a series of movies with Don Knotts, and continued to do voice work, including Barnacle Boy and SpongeBob.
Right.
Won 6 Primetime Emmy Awards. He attended Bowling Green State University, where he witnessed, of course, the Bowling Green Massacre.
Right.
There was no Bowling Green Massacre. Let's not get that started again. All right. He majored in television and radio and was a disc jockey on campus. He enlisted in the U.S. Army, and after serving from 56 to 58, he worked local television in, I think it was Cleveland, where he was discovered by Rose Marie, the comedic actress.
You're kidding.
She visited the station in 1961 as part of CBS's promotional practice of sending their major show stars directly to local affiliates. In this case, it was, of course, for the Dick Van Dyke Show. And while there, she viewed tapes of Conway and his comedy partner, some of the skits that they did for the local station. And she proceeded to take Conway under her wing. And when he departed from the local station, he moved to New York City, where, with Rose Marie's assistance, he auditioned for and gained a spot in the cast of ABC's The Steve Allen Show. And he remained a regular player throughout that show's entire run.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That's so cool. You never hear that anymore.
You know... Again, I'm a little kid at the time that he's starring in Disney films in the 1970s, right?
Apple Dumpling Gang
in 75, World's Greatest Athlete, 73, Gus, which of course I've talked about before because it's the first movie I ever saw in theaters, Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again, and may I say, not only the most successful film... for Roger Corman's company, I think it was New World Pictures, back in the 80s. But kind of one of my, I don't know if I would say guilty pleasures, because I actually think it's funny. I'm going to rent it to rewatch it. But one that I have quite a fondness for, Tim Conway, Don Knotts, written by Tim Conway, The Private Eyes from 1980.
Oh, yeah, I have to see that again. That's been so long. I don't think I saw the whole thing, actually.
So tell me a little bit about Tim Conway. I mean, I remember him, of course, so fondly. What do you remember? I mean, he was really great, wasn't he?
He was. And I saw him in around the time of Whose Line. Everybody was trying to develop all of these improvised hybrid shows where there's improv comedy as funny as Whose Line, but maybe with the plot. And there was one that was based with some of the Whose Line actors, not Ryan or anyone, but some of the other ones. And it was in a hotel, and it starred as the general manager, Tim Conway. And I went to a taping of this, and it was spectacularly unfunny, except for Tim Conway. Tim Conway did most of his scenes on a telephone, and he was spotlighted to one side while everybody else was improvising. And the funniest thing he could do was that his phone is cutting out as he's talking to somebody. So he seems to have an entire monologue going on, but he's only saying key words throughout the whole thing. It was really spectacular to see that skill set. And I guess it was like his comedy go-to when an entire, not just pilot episode, but the entire concept is sucking the wind out of the live studio audience. He brings it, single-handedly brings it, and gets master laughs, unannounced to the director or anyone else. He just does that. and is amazing. So that's my fondest memory of Tim Conway.
I think it's really interesting, and I'd be curious, Dean, how many of these people you've encountered. Maybe there's more than I than I can obviously think of. But I mentioned he wrote Private Eyes. He was a comedy writer, in addition to performer, and and obviously there have been so many famous ones, especially to come out of television, right? The Steve Allen Show and the Your Show of Shows. So many of the writers, the great comedy writers, became great comedy performers. The Mel Brooks, the Woody Allen, the Carl Reiner, you know, on and on and on and on. But he also was a really gifted improvisational performer.
He was.
And I want to know, is that rare to be both a gifted and prolific comedy writer, as well as a gifted and prolific improvisational performer?
Well, I always say that improv is jazz writing, right? Similar to a musician that can compose symphonies, theoretically, if well-versed and well-trained, can also play jazz, because you can improvise off of key fundamentals in music. Similarly, that to me was Tim Conway's gift, was that he, while his characters were spectacular and very precise and hilarious with the tics and everything, he also had an eye, even in the sketch, for driving the story. So he wouldn't be one of these improvisers that would just come out, I'm the guy with the beanbag on my head, and then just be the guy with the beanbag on the head with nary a thought on how you advance the narrative. And to my mind, and from what I saw of Tim Conway's sketch work, was that he was driving narrative as well, he had the knowledge that his character had to move narrative forward, which is very rare for people doing, you know, what hilarious character work often is just, that's the showcase in itself, not trying to do a scene from with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah, I mean, so it's kind of this triple that is what makes him so rare, right? Because he's able to write story, and story is structure. Narrative is always structure. And it should come out of character. He was able to play character. And as you say, he was able to riff and explore in the moment. And I don't know, I just feel like that combination of three attributes, there's not a lot of people that necessarily are great at all three.
No, or have the energy for all three. I know there was a producer from The X-Files who's one of his first jobs, one of his first early producing jobs, was working just after Carol Burnett was canceled. Tim Conway did a sketch comedy show called The Tim Conway Show. And it was, you know, some silent, but it was just a series of gags, some only 2 seconds long, that were all these sketches. And apparently all the writers would just write a couple things, go for lunch, drink a 3-martini lunch, and be useless after work. And it was Tim Conway who would stay and write these bloody sketches to get to have something ready to shoot the day after so that you can get these shows out. And the producer said he couldn't believe the superhuman effort he put in when all the other writers were letting him down. Hence why the show didn't last long.
You know, what's interesting is I think his job right after the Carol Burnett Show was the Tim Conway Show. His job right before the Carol Burnett Show was the Tim Conway Show. There were two efforts.
Oh,
and so, I think the one afterwards was like, okay, well, the first one didn't work, but now he's Tim Conway of the Carol Burnett Show. It's bound to work.
Well, it's hard to sketch comedy shows.
You know, he and Harvey Korman would tour in, you know.
Yeah, they do Vegas shows.
But with new sketches. They would do new sketches, and they would tour and everything in any way. Very, very successful. So, Tim Conway, we only have a few minutes left, and I there's something I really want to talk to you about, because it's apropos of what I'm about to start editing for Truth Is Out There. The Truth Is Still Out There. I saw a documentary. Now, you may recall Dean, when in May of 2017, I split LA and ended up driving about 8,000, 9,000 miles back and forth across the country.
Yeah, without your sunglasses, because you never wear them, and now you have cataracts. Just saying.
Largely using the trip as an opportunity to explore different mysteries, and as well as visit different places to find out the stories of those places that are told and embodied by the populations living there presently.
Right.
And one of these towns that I visited was Bisbee, Arizona, a former mining town, I think 6 miles from the border of Mexico. And I was stunned to realize that not only was Bisbee at one time one of the wealthiest towns in America, this copper mining town, but it was the second largest city in terms of population west of the Mississippi after San Francisco.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
And it was a mining town.
Right.
And so I visited in May of 2017. And I learned a lot about the history of it. And I'm taking on ghost tours of the town because there is a lot of ghostly activity in Bisbee. And it made me wonder, right, if we accept that there are what we're going to call ghosts, be they energetic echoes of people that have passed, or but wondering about the unique geographical, you know, geological nature of that town, where these hills are still rimmed with copper, which is a conductive element.
Right.
Does energy get trapped in there, in that cauldron? And is that one of the reasons why maybe there is so much of this paranormal energetic activity?
Say, because, you know, that's right. You wear copper rings, you know, that all supposed to have those health benefits. What are, if you are surrounded by a ring of copper in the landscape itself?
But also, apropos of our conversation of, you know, what that which gets suppressed or repressed or disowned gets hungry and will act up and will emerge often at the least opportune times.
Right.
And I am beginning to wonder whether that is true even when the participants are long since dead. After all, there's a reason that stories seemingly long buried, nevertheless will, from time to time, find the light of day. And Bisbee is one of these places where such a story finally saw the light of day a month after I was there. And there is a documentary that chronicles this fact, made by Robert Greene. It's a terrific documentary. It's called Bisbee 17. And it documents the town's efforts to recreate the mass deportation of striking mine workers in 1917.
Wow.
The International Workers of the World Union sought to organize there. The miners were striking for safety conditions in the mines.
I bet they were.
The opposition to them argued that they were being unpatriotic because there was a war effort going on.
All right.
And so the sheriff of Cochise County, which is based in Tombstone, Arizona,
very good,
deputized dozens of men, maybe even hundreds, who on one particular morning in 1917 rounded up all the striking workers and all those who had exhibited or were suspected of having sympathy towards them. They were rounded up, placed in a ball field. I love that it's a baseball field, which actually still exists, as do all the locations where that were intricate to this particular story. this ball field is in fact the longest continually operating baseball field in America.
Wow.
And can you think of any more American symbol than baseball? And these prisoners are lined up there and then loaded onto cattle cars.
Oh, no.
And driven by rail out to the deserts of New Mexico and dropped off to die.
Dropped off.
To die, basically, in the middle of the deserts, right, in the middle of summer. And told, so if we ever see you in Bisbee again, you will be killed.
Holy crap.
90% of these workers were, in fact, immigrants. So a case could be made that this was an effort to purge the community of undesirables.
Okay.
So here we are in 2017, where immigration and deportation and situations along the border are so the topics of the day, and often parsed out in patriotic versus unpatriotic terms.
Right.
And here's a town wrestling with its past, of which it really did not speak for 100 years. The descendants of the people who participated. I mean, there was even one brother who was deputized who had to deport his own brother.
Wow.
And you think, how could he do that? Oh, well, one of the ways he could do that was he felt he was protecting his brother from the mob rule that might kill his brother.
Oh.
So I'm going to make sure he safely gets on that train and safely gets out of town. It's a terrific documentary. And Bisbee's a fascinating town because, yeah, as I mentioned to you, it's in close proximity. It's in the shadow of Tombstone. And Tombstone is one of those towns that just absolutely disgusts me because it's based entirely, its economy is based entirely on a particular type of tourism. A tourism that's based on continually telling, reenacting, and adhering to a fictional story, and a fictional story that upholds the idea of violence as problem solver.
Right. Yes. And justice, like, at the end of a gun.
And like so many of the towns and places that we have visited, Dean, in our travels, it's a tourism that says, you know what, we can go ahead and lie about where these events actually took place, because where they actually took place, there's no place to build out the tourism infrastructure to make money off of it. I'm thinking, for example, the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin.
In Berlin, right?
As we realized, oh, that's been moved.
Yeah.
To a place where they could have easy access to gift shops.
Yeah. That makes it easier.
Hell, this is a country where, you know, visit London Bridge. Wait, London Bridge is in America? Yep, it's in Arizona. around the world, I find this place, you know, this idea. I mean, it's one of the reasons why the crossroads where, Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil, apparently exists in a half dozen or more cities in Mississippi. Wherever they can make a buck off of it, they're going to say that's where it is. History, yep, of course, be damned.
Well, exactly. There's also 3 different grave sites of Jesse James. So, you know, that's not unusual. It's what we do.
But here's Bisbee, a town that I was fascinated by and charmed by and really loved, because here's one of those towns who had this glorious history, whose reason for existence had long since vanished, and yet, all these decades later, there is a thriving community there. There's it's full of life.
Yeah.
And as opposed to Tombstone, which has no life, it has financial success, but a financial success that's built entirely upon death.
Right.
You know, and the stories that we choose to tell build the world we live in. The stories we choose to believe build the world that we live in.
It's called one's culture.
And where we put our energy, that is what will grow. And this brings me back to that which is untold. Uh-oh. If you put your energy towards ignoring a story, towards repressing a story, towards suppressing a story, that story will grow.
Interesting.
It may grow under the surface. It may take time before it finds an opening to come out.
Right.
But when it does come out, it comes out with a power that might astonish you. And certainly the power of reenacting what took place in 1917 in Bisbee astonished the people who took part in that reenactment 100 years later.
I bet. Wow. And I got to see this documentary now.
You mean part two of The Truth is Out There? Well, I'm editing it. See what I did? See what I did?
I like it.
Bisbee 17 from Robert Greene. It's a terrific piece of work. And and one of the people it focuses on, one of the reenactors, is a young man, Fernando, who just is wonderful, wonderful, such a riveting presence. And so heartfelt and open about his own experiences. And anyway, I met him. He served me at Twee's Noodle Shop, I believe, in Bisbee when I came through town.
No, you're kidding.
I had read about this noodle shop, and it, above all other reasons, was why I was determined to make the drive from L.A. to Bisbee one day, because I basically wanted to go to Twee's Noodle Shop, and it was worth the visit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going. That's it. Get in my car. I'm going.
Well, maybe we'll have a screening of Truth is Out There sometime. There's a wonderful Main Street theater there. And our friend Renee Harper, who arranged the ghost tours for me and who I later was able to shoot an interview with in Long Beach, she's based there and is all kinds of terrific. So it'd be fun to do a screening there at some point. Anyway, we're over time. But like I said, I think this was an interesting episode about a lot of different parts of 20th century American history.
Yep.
And you can find every episode we've ever done at Blog Talk Radio. You can find an increasing amount week after week at chillpackhollywood.com. We're going to leave everybody with a little bit more of Doris Day. Until next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
Who's the most popular person? Loves a tuba. I can't help but thinking it's no one else. Everybody loves me. Gee, I feel just about fancy tall. I feel having a ball. I feel, well, I feel just like Pollyanna. I should work. Not for nothing. Everybody loves me. Yes, they do. And I love everybody. Since I fell in love with you.
Call me Pollyanna.
Belated spoiler alert.